Our next case for this morning is Christopher McDonald against Anthony Ramos.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Kate Zell for Petitioner Appellant Christopher McDonald. I would like to take the time that we have this morning to focus on Mr. McDonald's ineffective assistance of counsel claim. That claim is based on a needless error on the part of trial counsel that resulted from a lack of utter diligence when representing Mr. McDonald at trial. Counsel's error cost Mr. McDonald at least an additional 15 years in prison. At trial, Mr. McDonald had a monumental...
That's a little bit speculative. I mean, if we assume that Mr. McDonald was a model prisoner, then yes. But it could have been up to the whole stated term, right, if he had forfeited his good time credits. I mean, people do. You know, people misbehave in prison and lose good time credits all the time.
Mm-hmm. It's speculative whether or not he will lose them. It is not speculative whether or not he is entitled to those rights as a matter of law under Illinois' Truth in Sentencing Act. So I would agree that it is speculative that he would lose those credits, but as a matter of law, he gets them, and he has a due process interest in protecting those credits.
So you interpret Illinois law actually almost to be an indeterminate sentencing law that gives a sentence of, say, 15 to 30 years. It could be as short as 15. It could be as long as the longer end.
I interpret the Sentencing Act and the Truth in Sentencing Act to state that a particular sentence is so long with a particular allotment of good time credit, or for the case of first-degree murder, no good time credit. That is just the terms of the Sentencing Act. So I don't think they would classify it as an indeterminate sentence. The sentence itself is, you know, 20 years at 50% good time credit. And the common understanding is that a sentence will accompany, or good conduct credit will accompany a sentence.
So with ineffectiveness as assistance counsel claims, one of the things we need to concern ourselves is whether counsel had a rational strategic reason for declining the jury instruction on second-degree murder, or for advising Mr. McDonald to decline that. And the state seems to imply that he had something to lose by getting that instruction. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Sure. I mean, it is a strategy to decide to forego an instruction on second-degree murder, and we are not arguing that the strategy is in itself wrong. We're arguing that here the defendant himself had to make that decision, and no matter what strategy may have applied to that, he could not have even made that decision. He did not know the full extent of the strategic decision he was making. And so in order for him...
Since he didn't know the facts on the other side of the balance, it was automatically unreasonable.
I think it was uninformed, for sure. And under Illinois law, it has to be an informed decision. And in this case, counsel's failure to tell him this information directly, it would have affected his decision, as he has stated. And in Moore v. Bryant, this court, looking at misinformation of good time credits, this court recognized that the effect of these good time credits is the very type of information that a defendant would take into account and would impact his decision-making, and that was in the plea context. But certainly this court has recognized that good time credits have an effect on the length of the sentence, and this is important information for a defendant to have.
Now, of course, so does parole eligibility, and yet, as your opponents have strenuously argued, that parole is certainly a collateral consequence that does not need to be brought into the original trial. Why isn't this?
I think the difference is the way that the act is structured, and that here there is an initial grant of good time credit, whereas with parole, it all depends on the discretion of the Department of Corrections or the Parole Review Board or whoever's responsible for making that decision. Whereas here, the sentence itself and how the Sentencing Act defines good time credit, that happens by the sentencing court. It is not done by a separate civil administrative scheme. It is in the statute itself that you get this much credit.
I understand your argument. This really is a state-by-state or jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction, statute-by-statute position. Some other state or the federal government might not have a system where the sentencing court has so much influence over good time credit.
Definitely, and I would say the sentencing court, it imposes the good time credit, but they're defined by statute. So it's not as though the sentencing court could say, oh, and you're going to get less good time credit here. I mean, they are part of the sentence itself. So I would argue that, yes, it does vary depending on the jurisdiction, for sure, and the applicable laws.
The second degree instruction, if it had been requested, would have been given.
That's correct. Yeah, the trial court asked him if he would like it.
Mm-hmm. But that would the potential of a second degree verdict would put a pretty big hole in the self-defense theory, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't think so. Under Illinois law, the common practice and the suggested practice for courts is that in a first-degree murder case, whenever there is evidence of self-defense, the jury should be given the opportunity to decide whether the defendant's subjective belief that he needed to defend himself was objectively reasonable. So it doesn't, it provides sort of a third option for particular for self-defense scenarios.
I just wonder whether it makes acquittal quite unlikely.
It might increase the chances of a conviction, but in the context of Mr. McDonald's decision, he couldn't decide whether that was a reasonable strategy because he did not know that, yes, my chances for conviction might be increased, but my chances at spending the next 47 years of my life in prison would be significantly reduced. So I think you're correct, but and it does involve a strategic decision about what are my odds at trial and what could I be acquitted for or convicted of. So it increases the chance of the conviction, but would also decrease the amount of time he would spend in prison if convicted of second-degree murder. Returning to that prejudice prong, I'll just return back to counsel's unreasonable performance. Under Strickland, you look at the counsel's performance under the circumstances of the particular case, and in this case, this was a grave decision that Mr. McDonald had to make, and counsel utterly abandoning him and not telling him about the sentences that he faced left him, as we discussed before, completely uninformed.
Of course, mistakes of state law are not things that we worry about on habeas corpus or collateral review. We have to, and so this may have been misinformation by counsel about a particular factor of state law, but is that something that would really be a ground for habeas?
Your Honor, state law informs that counsel has a responsibility in this context. I believe it was People v. Dominguez, the state court said that this decision must be made knowingly and intelligently after due consultation with counsel. In Medina, People v. Medina, the state court said, in order to make an intelligent and informed decision, the defendant obviously requires the defense of counsel. So it defines the scope of defense to counsel, but the federal right at issue here is the right under Strickland v. Washington to effective assistance of counsel. So, no, we are not trying to vindicate a state right here. It's his federal right to counsel. Other factors that demonstrate that this here is a direct, that the good time credits under Illinois law are a direct consequence to the conviction include how the Department of Justice itself treats good time credits. It does not grant them. There's nowhere in the rules and regulations.
Does the record tell us whether there was ever any attempt to resolve the case on a plea rather than go to trial?
Not on a plea, Your Honor. No, that's...
I mean, in every case like this in state court, there is an attempt by the defense, I would assume, to try to get a plea out to a lesser included offense.
Correct.
I imagine that this case would be...
Right. My client actually has, he alleged in the district court proceedings and in state court that he would have pled guilty had he known these consequences and that he did not know them at the plea stage. And that's what I do not have in the record.
Does the record tell us about any discussion about that?
It does not tell us about any plea discussions, but I would argue that that isn't necessarily indicative of whether or not the jury would have convicted on second-degree murder in light of the evidence at trial.
I agree with Judge Tinder that once you decide to go for broke with a self-defense, you have a little chance of acquittal there. But once you put a lesser-included offense into the mix, his chances of walking out of that courtroom are almost non-existent.
That's correct, but his chances of spending far less time in prison are much greater. And I think this decision is not as simple as should I be acquitted, should I just risk it all. It is should I risk it all for this incredibly long 60-year sentence that I didn't realize had to be served in full, that I thought would be like every other sentence? Or is it something I'm willing to risk, or I'm willing to risk a shorter sentence knowing more likely that the jury would acquit me on that? I mean, that's part of the reason there's prejudice here. If it is more likely that he would have been convicted of second-degree murder had it been on the table, then likely he would have been convicted of that, especially considering the jury acquitted him of knowing first-degree murder.
See, I think you're in a better position to argue ineffective assistance if there was never any discussion about a plea to a lesser offense.
It might have been.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bendick.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. Counsel, my name is Leah Bendick from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of Respondent. And because opposing counsel has focused her remarks on the first ineffective assistance of counsel claim, I, too, will focus on that issue in absence of any questions from Your Honors on the second issue. So then turning to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, the specific and very narrow question presented here was whether the failure to inform about the early release possibilities connected to second-degree murder was deficient performance. The state appellate court specifically held that this was not deficient performance while relying on analogous cases in the guilty plea context that find no deficient performance given that early release possibilities are a collateral consequence of a conviction.
But that really is the question here, isn't it? When you have a statute that says somebody convicted of second-degree murder, quote, shall receive one good day of good conduct credit for each day, and it can only be revoked following charges, that's certainly not like, parole situations where the parole board has absolute discretion about whether to let somebody out or not. You're not throwing yourself on someone's mercy. You can be the model prisoner and go to school and work well in the prison, you know, play well with others or whatever, and you get that time. Isn't there a fatal flaw in the ability of this man to weigh the three options or the three possibilities? He only thought there were two, but there were three.
The situation of parole eligibility and good conduct credits under Illinois have two very important similarities that show that good conduct credits should also be deemed a collateral consequence. Those two factors are that it is not the sentencing court that makes the specific decisions about the amount of good conduct credit that will be allowed or revoked during the duration of serving the term.
But we begin, though, with a statutory scheme where the good conduct credit is being earned. We don't begin with a minute of parole.
That's true, but because of the fact that they are still approximate at best, because during the entire length of the serving of the term, they are subject to change, and the amount of change...
They're not approximate at all for the first-degree murder, because they're zero.
Well, that's correct, certainly. But it is true that at the moment of sentencing, neither the sentencing court nor the attorneys know exactly how much of the sentence imposed will actually be served.
But what you do know is the rate at which good conduct will be earned. And you don't know, of course, with parole, whether anybody will ever decide whether to let somebody out or not. Society's views about the seriousness of an offense may change over time. There could be things that have nothing to do with the prisoner's behavior that affect parole, plus or minus.
There are courts of appeals cases in this line of authority about parole eligibility that specifically defined collateral consequence as one that is outside the responsibility and control of the sentencing court.
And what I'm suggesting is the sentencing court, if it sentences to second-degree murder, is incorporating within that sentence a good time credit regime in Illinois. Now, not in federal court. That's not how good time credits work. It's BOP's responsibility to figure out what they're going to be, at what rate they'll be awarded, and so forth. But the sentencing court, by choosing first-degree murder, is choosing a regime under which there are none.
Well, certainly, though, although the sentencing court may be aware about this initial award, the court has no role in the way that that amount can change over time during the duration of the sentence.
Over time, I agree with you, but a sentencing court in a second-degree murder case could not, as I understand the Illinois statute, issue a sentence that says, and Mr. McDonald will he'll receive only one day of good conduct credit for every 2 days. You know, it doesn't have the ability to change the statutory system.
That's true, which is further evidence that the sentencing court is not directly involved in those decisions.
Well, the system it's incorporated within the sentence, just like a mandatory maximum and a mandatory minimum. Sentencing court has limits on its discretion from statutes as opposed to from administrative discretion.
It is also key to remember here that because we're on habeas review, the question is the reasonableness of the state court's decision. And because of the fact that there is this line of cases in the parole eligibility context, as well as a line of court of appeals cases that hold that in the guilty plea context, there is no ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to inform about collateral consequences, certainly the state court's decision is consistent with these lines of cases, which make it all the more difficult under this court's precedent to find that it was an unreasonable application of Strickland, because collateral consequences are at least somewhat, even if not perfectly, analogous to the good conduct credit situation.
Well, I think you're right in that the key question is, what's the question we're asking? Are we asking a question, did the state courts reasonably define collateral consequences, or are we asking the question, when you take the entire state legislative structure into account, did Mr. McDonald receive below standard assistance from his counsel?
Well, I would say
didn't even tell him that there might be an issue here.
Well, I would say it's probably the former, because petitioner,
I would assume it would.
centers his argument on needing to show that good conduct credits in Illinois are not collateral consequences like parole eligibility. Mm-hmm. And I would also like to point out that he heavily relies on his reply brief at both page 7 and 10 on the Greenholz case in an attempt to show that parole eligibility is different than good conduct credits. However, that is a mischaracterization of that case, because that case instead concerns parole eligibility versus revocation of parole, which certainly is a very different decision than the availability of good conduct credits. And so again, because all we are concerned with here is whether the state court reasonably acted consistently with at least a reasonable analogy to these parole eligibility cases, that is why habeas relief is inappropriate. And one further point is the fact that this line of cases is in the guilty plea context, which is all the more serious than the jury instruction situation, because in the guilty plea context, a conviction is certainly going to result. But in the jury instruction context, it is presenting the jury with another option in which acquittal is still a possibility, even if less likely. And because of that, at the moment of deciding about a jury instruction, there is still an additional step between that decision and any possibility of how a sentence served might be affected.
But
and
of
so
course,
it's all the
if
more
counsel
collateral.
Advises somebody that the mandatory maximum for an offense is 10 years and it's really 30 years, that's regarded as ineffective performance, putting to one side whether the prejudice prong in such a case would be met.
Well, certainly the district court here properly recognized that Your Honor's precedent, the Seventh Circuit's precedent, does make a distinction between misadvice and silence. And here all we have is silence. And again, the key point is the collateral consequence, if that's an appropriate way to characterize Illinois good conduct credits. And at the very least, it's a reasonable analogy. And because the state court was relying in this guilty plea context and did so consistently with this long line of parole eligibility courts of appeals cases, that makes it all the more difficult on habeas review for petitioner to somehow show that it was unreasonable for the state court to make a decision that would be contrary to this long line of cases in what is, at first glance, certainly a reasonable analogy. As a final point, I'd like to also point out that I would just like to say that if this court reaches the prejudice prong, as stated in the brief, we would ask that this court remand to the district court, because neither the state court nor the district court reached the prejudice prong. And since I have a little more time, I'll just very briefly address the second issue about the ex parte hearings. While this claim can be affirmed, the rejection of habeas relief can be affirmed either due to the lack of a constitutional violation or due to harmless error. I will begin with harmless error, since that's the ground that the district court relied upon. Now, petitioner offers three reasons why, in his view, that there was no harmless error here, but each of them is not supported by the record. First, petitioner alleges that by issuing the bonds, the witnesses would have been pressured to provide pro-prosecution testimony, but that is mere speculation that is not supported by the record, because the bonds under state law, both statutory and case law, only have forfeiture of those bonds if the person simply does not appear. It's not contingent on the content of testimony. Secondly, there is no basis to speculate that the district judge would have issued the bonds while believing that petitioner was dangerous and that a bench trial would have been precluded, which is petitioner's second point, because after all, there is a procedure under state law for seeking substitution of judge, and that was not used here. And finally, as to petitioner's speculation that shackling was due to the trial court's belief of dangerousness, there are three reasons that this should be rejected. First, the state appellate court found there was inadequate record support that the shackles even occurred. Secondly, petitioner has failed to make two links here. He has not linked the shackling to any harm on the jury's verdict because he has not shown that the jury, if even assuming for the moment that the shackling occurred, that the jury could see this, as can be seen at pages 111 and 112 of the appendix, which shows that the very undetailed affidavits that assert that shackling occurred does not show if the jury could see it. And so for that reason, the shackling also is not a basis for harmful error. And as a result, the district court should affirm, and we would ask that both of these two claims be rejected. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Does she have any additional time? I'll give you a minute to rebut if you would like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to just return to the habeas standard in this case and whether or not the state court unreasonably applied Supreme Court precedent. And it is our position that the Supreme Court unreasonably applied Strickland in categorically dismissing this as a collateral consequence. And Strickland requires looking at the circumstances of the case, the situation the defendant is facing, and whether or not counsel's conduct was reasonable under those circumstances and in light of prevailing professional norms. And here, norms about counseling the defendant and making sure he is informed were not abided by, and counsel did not take into account the stakes at issue and what would have been important to the defendant in making his decision. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And you were appointed, were you not, Ms. Zell? We appreciate very much your assistance to your client and to the court, and thank you as well to the state.